on. There you go. We'll get back to it in more detail at some point, I'm sure. But basically, in Genesis, you know, these 30, 32, 33, what's happening is Jacob is returning unto his kindred. Of course, we had the confrontation with Laban, and then in 31, and then in 32, Jacob is coming on his way, and the angels of God, it says in verse 1, if you want to look there with me in 32, verse 1, the angels of God met him, and when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's host," and he called the name of that place Mahanaim. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, and to the land of Seir, unto the country of Edom. And I think there's some important details in 32 about this reuniting between Esau and Jacob that we should take note of as we get into Genesis 33. And that is the fact that Jacob is very cognizant of the fact that he's coming back into his homeland and that his brother Esau is going to be there. Because if you remember, they did not have a very amicable parting when Jacob first went into the land where Laban dwelt, to go back there to take a bride and all that. In fact, it says that Esau hated his brother when he left. So it's very strong language. So Esau, you know, had some very negative feelings, to say the least, about his brother because he had taken his birthright from him. We all remember that story. So Esau, though it's been these 20 years later, or excuse me, Jacob rather, is still, you know, being very conscious of the fact that it did not end well with his brother. And he's not entirely sure how he's going to be received when he comes back into the land. This is the first time they're seeing each other since that whole thing where he stole his birthright. You know, so that's kind of a big deal, obviously. And in fact, if you remember that story, Esau had even at least in word planned to kill his brother, to do him harm. He was going to slay him, right? So very serious thing. You know, he's very upset. Not a minor detail in the story. And I think that's important to keep in mind when you're thinking about him coming back and meeting with Esau, because of the fact it kind of you can see how it tempers Jacob's behavior towards his brother. Okay, and Jacob does some things in the lead up to his reuniting with his brother that we could learn from when it comes to how we're going to deal with somebody who is hostile or potentially hostile towards us. Okay, whether justified or not. Now, I'm not going to suggest that Esau is hostile towards him at this point. Obviously, we just read in the story they have a very nice reunion when they finally meet each other. But what, you know, I wonder about in the story is that because of the fact of what Jacob did leading up to this immediate reuniting? Did he kind of cool him down then and there? Did Esau go out to meet him in wrath? Or did he just go out to meet him with 400 men because that's how you meet people that you're just really friendly with? You take 400 of your trained men and you go meet them, right? So there's, you know, the Bible doesn't explicitly say this, and I'm not saying that I know the answer, okay? But I do know this, that the Bible reads like any other book. I mean, not like any other book, don't get me wrong, but that it's written in a lot of ways like literature you would read elsewhere, right? And we've probably all read stories where, you know, sometimes the plots are just so, from page 3, you're like, I know how this book ends, right? Because the writer isn't very good about, you know, the subplot, the subtext, right? So the Bible is really good about that. The Bible doesn't just give things away. Sometimes God, I think, just gives us enough detail for us to kind of have to mull these things over and think about them for us to kind of come to these conclusions on our own. And again, I'm not saying I'm right. Maybe Esau was just really excited and just wanted these 400 guys to meet his brother, okay? Maybe he's just like, you guys got to meet Jacob. He's great. I mean, the last time I saw him, it wasn't so great, you know. Well, tell us about the last time you saw him. You saw, oh, he stole my birthright and I threatened to kill him. But, you know, 20 years later, I've cooled off and he's such a great guy. You got to come meet him. So hopefully people can understand what I'm kind of coming from a little bit tonight. And even if, you know, regardless of what Esau's intent was when he went to meet his brother, we still see that Jacob is on guard about the whole situation. That he's kind of apprehensive and he's taking extra precautions because he doesn't know how Esau's going to react. And I don't know that those precautions weren't unfounded. You know, perhaps it was a wise thing that Jacob did in all the precautions that he took, and we'll get into that. But notice again in verse 3 of chapter 32, we're going to kind of get a twofer tonight. Jacob sent messengers before him to his Esau, his brother, unto the land of Seir, the country of Edom. So he's sending messengers, right? And he commanded him, saying, thus shall you speak unto my lord Esau, thy servant Jacob saith thus, I have sojourned with Laban, I have stayed there till now. So you can already see how he's being very humble, he's being very meek, he's calling him Lord, he's calling himself his servant, right? He's entreating him. And he's talking about how he's oxen and maid servants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I may find grace in thy sight. And the messengers came, returned to Jacob, saying, we came to thy brother Esau, and he also cometh to meet thee, and 400 men with him. Right? So that's kind of cause for concern, you know, for Jacob. He's kind of like, well, and they don't really tell us what exactly it was, how the meeting went. You know, maybe Esau just kind of heard him out and was like, all right, well, tell him we're coming. You know, he didn't say good or bad against him. But he does bring 400 men. So, I mean, to me, is when I'm reading the details, I'm kind of like, maybe Esau is still raw about this, but maybe not. Verse 7, then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed and divided the people that was with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two bands and said, if Esau come to the one company and smite it, then the other company which is left shall escape. And Jacob said, O God, my father of Abraham, God of Isaac, and the Lord, which said unto me, return unto thy country, to thy kindred, and I will dwell with thee. So on and so forth. So he divides these companies up, right? And we learn exactly what those divisions are a little bit later. Of course, after he sends them on ahead, there's this famous story in the end of chapter 32, and maybe I'll just have to make a point of preaching on this on Sunday night, where he wrestles with the Lord, where the Lord comes to him, and he wrestles with him, and he's given that limp in his leg, okay? But the details I want us to take out of the story are just those concerning Esau tonight, okay? Because that's what it then rolls into. You kind of have the whole story of him meeting Esau, then there's just like this little segue there, or just this rather, you know, commercial break, whatever you want to call it, where he wrestles the angel, okay? Then it comes back to the main plot of where we're at. It says in verse 33, and Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau came, and with him 400 men, right? And he divided the children unto Leah, children unto Leah and unto Rachel and unto the two handmaids. So that's how he's dividing them up. Leah, Rachel, Bilhah, and Ziphlah, those are the two handmaids and their respective children, okay? And he put the handmaids and their children foremost, and Leah and her children after, and Rachel and Joseph hindermost. So he's kind of, I mean, you know, how do you not play favorites in that situation, right? You just spread them all out the same laterally, you know, just one, you know, so they all come to Esau at the same time and to see who he takes out, right? Because this is what Jacob's thinking, right? This is why he's separating this way. Because he goes on and explains and says, you know, if he attacks the first band, you know, I'm paraphrasing, then the other band will escape. So obviously the one you're putting all the way in the back is the one that you cherish the most. Which, you know, stands to, and it, also it is the weaker, right? Because it's just Joseph at this point, right? It's just Joseph and Rachel. You know, there's not, Reuben and Simeon and Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, you know, these older sons are probably grown men. They are grown men, in fact. And we'll see, you know, next week that they're even capable of inflicting great harm on people, right? They themselves are people that are used to conflict, apparently. So maybe that's part of it, too. He's saying, well, let me put these elder in the front, these older bands, even though Leah had the elder children. That doesn't exactly work out. And the handmaids are in front of her. But, you know, it could still stand to reason a little bit. Obviously, what's really probably going on, though, he's just saying, you know, Rachel's who I love the most. My sons that came from Rachel are who I care about the most. These I cannot go without. So he's kind of playing favorites. But, you know, at least he's consistent, right? Joseph, from the get-go, right, had loved Rachel more than anyone else. That's who he labored for Laban for. The only reason he ended up with these other wives is because of, you know, the treachery of Laban. So at least he's consistent. But imagine being one of those, you know, handmaids. You know, like, you go up front, you know, like, thanks, you know. Don't expect a Christmas card from her. But anyway. So he sends them up there, puts, you know, lines them out, and it says, and Esau ran to meet him. He put the handmaids and their children foremost, and Leah and her children after, and he passed over before them. So credit for that, he put himself in harm's way, right? He gets out in front of all of them, and it's, you know, it's going to befall him before it befalls anybody else if things don't go that well. And then obviously, in verse 3, it says, and he passed over the ground before them and bowed himself to the ground seven times until he came near to his brother. And Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him and wept. So, not the reaction that I'm thinking of Joseph because he had a similar reaction when he was reunited with his brethren, that Jacob was expecting, not the reaction he was probably anticipating, obviously, with all the precautions that he's taking, you know, and the prayer in chapter 32, that he's praying to God and he's asking for help. He's saying in verse 11, deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he will come and smite me and the mother with the children. So this is probably coming as a shock to him, okay? And he lifted up his eyes, verse 5, and he saw the women and the children. He said, who are those with thee? And he said, the children which God hath graciously given thy children. Then the handmaids came near, they and their children, and they bowed themselves. And Leah also with her children came near and bowed themselves. And after that, and after came Joseph near and Rachel, and they bowed themselves. And he said, what meanest thou by all this drove which I met? And he said, these are to find grace in the sight of my Lord. And Esau said, I have enough, my brother. Keep that thou hast unto thyself. And Jacob said, nay, I pray thee, if now I have found grace in thy sight, then receive my present at my hand. For therefore have I seen thy face as though I had seen the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me. And kind of what he's saying there with I've seen the face of God, he's basically saying, you know, my life was in your hands. You know, you could have just as easily destroyed me. And that certainly seems to be the case. I mean, I'd assume that it is the case because of the way Jacob's behaving, all the precautions he's taking. It sounds like he wasn't any match. You know, otherwise, why all the to-do, right? And yet, remember, even when Laban caught up with him when he first fled, Laban said, it is in my power to do thee harm, right? And except God had spoken to him and intervened on Jacob's behalf, that's what would have happened. So Jacob is kind of defenseless to a certain degree against stronger forces, you know, militarily. So I think that's kind of what he's saying there. He's like, you know, I've seen the face of God. Basically, you know, I've had a near-death experience, right? Like my life is in your hand. You could have taken it from me just as is the case with God. So what I want to kind of focus in on, though, tonight, we got through a lot of the details there about this reuniting, and really just the application is that, you know, when we have people that we're maybe not right with or people that we're at odds with or there's conflict, you know, we should seek to smooth those things over, right? Now, obviously, I don't know, probably none of us is in a conflict as intense as what Jacob is experiencing where he's worried about, you know, entire families being wiped out, like literally killed and things like that. But, you know, you and I are going to face conflict in our lives day to day. We're going to, you know, in the workplace, in our homes, just going about our business, even in church and things like that, you know, we are going to come into conflict that we're going to have friction with other people from time to time. It's inevitable, okay? And so we can learn a few things about what Jacob did. And basically, one of the things that he did is, you know, he sent these droves of beasts before him, right? He sent gifts, essentially, unto who he assumed was his enemy. You know, he was trying to, you know, butter him up, whatever you want to call it. But he was trying to show him, hey, I'm trying to make amends, I'm trying to do right. And the Bible does talk about this. The Bible does talk about, you know, the way we speak to people that maybe we're upset with and the way that we treat them. You know, it matters, you know, and we should make sure that we don't try to stir up other people, that we don't try to create more conflict than is necessary. You know, we should seek to live peaceably with all men, the Bible says. You know, we should try to be at peace with one another. We should seek to do good unto all men, especially and those that are of the household of faith. You know, we should seek to be a peaceful people that get along in the world. You know, I think sometimes when people attend a church where the preaching is hard and it's, you know, the Bible is a hard book. The Bible has some very hard sayings in it. The Bible takes a strong stand. And we certainly believe all these things and we take a stand, you know, when we must. But I think sometimes when we come to a church where maybe the preaching's got a little bit of a harder edge, people think like, well, that's how we need to be out in the world, right? Like maybe they think that, you know, their favorite preacher, the preachers that they see just ripping face, they get this idea that that's how they live 24/7, that they're just going around just everywhere ripping face, you know, just getting, it's like, no, that's not it, you know. There's a time and place to be like that. Obviously, We have to stamp with the foot, pound with the fist, lift up the voice, show our people, show his people their sins, right? We have to call things out. We have to preach the word of God. But the Bible also does admonish us, you know, in our lives to be people that seek peace, to seek peace and pursue it. And the Proverbs talks about this quite a bit. If you want to go to the book of Proverbs, you can go over to Proverbs. Let's have you go to Proverbs 21. Proverbs 21. One of the first things I point out is that in Genesis 32, what we saw is that Jacob sent messengers, right? He starts with his words. And he says, tell him, Jacob, you know, tell my lord Esau that Jacob, his servant, is come, right? So it's the things that he's saying, that's where he starts, right? He's trying to get his message across. Hey, there's no bad blood on my part, you know, I want to live at peace, you know, I'm coming back with humility, right? And what the Bible tells us in Proverbs 15, I'll just read to you, verse 1, it says, a soft answer turneth away wrath. A soft answer turneth away wrath. You know, sometimes the best way to handle somebody who's upset with us is just to be patient and kind and listen. You know, if people, because here's the thing, when people are angry with one another, a lot of times, you know, when someone decides to confront somebody that they're upset with, the other person can become very defensive, and the next thing you know, it just turns into like a flame war, right? It just gets out of hand. You know, one person's angry, and then they go and confront somebody else, and that person reacts in anger, and nothing's really resolved, right? And oftentimes, that's what happens. But the Bible says that a soft answer turneth away wrath. You know, when someone comes to you that's upset and angry, maybe the first thing we should ask ourselves is, are they right to be upset and angry? You know, maybe there is an offense on my part. Maybe there is I did something wrong. Maybe I did mess up on the job or whatever. Maybe, you know, I did offend somebody, okay? That's what we should ask ourselves. Is this a justifiable anger? Are they right to be upset? Rather than just instantly think, what do you mean? I'm never wrong, you know? You know, it's your fault. Why are you so big? You know, that's what people do, though, right? That's often how those interactions go. But the Bible says that a soft answer turneth away wrath. And it's amazing how many times, you know, when we're upset, you know, if we say something and then somebody might reply in a kind or patient way, that kind of calms us down, right? It kind of brings us down a notch and makes us, you know, be more open to have a more civil conversation and actually come to, you know, an agreement, you know, to kind of some kind of resolution, okay? It says, a soft answer turneth away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger, right? You know, this is great in any relationship, in any, you know, relationship. But how about particularly in the area of marriage, right? Because here's the thing, in marriage, you know, if you've been married long enough, you got the goods on each other. How can't you? If you live with this person for years, you know what they're like. You know their faults, you know their shortcomings, and they know yours. And, you know, marriage is a wonderful thing, but often there's conflict. You know, that just kind of comes with the territory. You pack sinners together anywhere, you know, they're going to be at odds with one another. You know, same is true for marriage. What you've got is two sinners, and then you compound the stress of that by having a bunch of little sinners often, right? So, you know, that's a good point to keep in mind, is that when we get into conflict with our spouses, to not use grievous words to stir up anger. Because if we've been married long enough, we know exactly what to say, and we know exactly how to say it to really just get under the skin, right? Well, what's the point of that, though? What good is that going to do? It's not going to do any good, right? And a brother offended is harder to be won than a strong city. You know, it's like the bars of a castle. I'm kind of paraphrasing the proverb right now. And you know, how much more so our spouses, we don't want to push them away. We should seek to have peace. We want to turn away wrath in those instances. Okay? So that's the first thing I point out with how did we get the reaction out of Esau that we saw? You say, well, Esau was coming out, you know, already with that on his heart. What he just wanted to meet his brother. He wanted to be reunited. And that's why he had such a strong emotional reaction, right? And that's why he was so glad to see him. You know, that may have been the case. But, you know, as I'm reading, you know, I've read the story, I mean, so many times, but when you really have to preach it and really break it down and kind of look for these things, some of the stuff jumps out a little bit more. I'm like, well, why the fear on Jacob's part? Why the prayer? Why the 400 men with Esau? You know, maybe he's just keeping himself safe, you know, amongst the people that are in the area. I don't know. But either way, it seems like that soft answer, you know, worked on Esau. Hey, thy servant is come to his Lord, right? Very humble, very meek. He didn't stir up wrath because remember, Jacob has the birthright. It's his. He didn't say, hey, I'm here to claim what's mine. Get going. It's been 20 years. You've had time enough. It's time for you to clear out, Esau. Those have been grievous words, right? To just immediately bring up that whole incident from 20 years ago where I stole your birthright. But he's in the right, right? He's got, it's true. That is true. In fact, we'll see that Esau later does leave of his own accord, showing you what kind of man Esau really was. But, you know, that's not the approach Jacob took. It was very humble, very meek, very soft answer. And it very well may have been what turned away the wrath of Esau if it had been there to begin with. I can't say for certain that it was. What else did he do? It was the gifts, right? What meanest thou this drove, right? Because he's sending these sheep and cattle ahead of him, right? Kind of softening it up. Hey, this is for you. This is for you. Did you go to Proverbs 21? Look at verse 14. A gift in secret pacifieth anger, and a reward in the bosom strong wrath. A gift in secret pacifieth anger, and a reward in the bosom strong wrath. It's hard to be mad at somebody when they do something nice for you, isn't it? It is. You know, you get upset, and it's like then that person does something really nice for you, just out of nowhere. It's like, I can't stay mad at you, you know. It makes it hard, you know. And this is a great principle to apply in your own life. You know, if you're at odds with somebody at work or something, do something nice for them. You know, you got some enemy at work, buy him lunch. Buy him a Coke. You know, say good morning and, you know, hey, I got donuts. You want a donut? I mean, that'll smooth, you know, hey, the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. It's true, right? So, you know, I believe that might be another thing. Go to Proverbs 13, okay? Because this next one just kind of makes the point I made earlier. It says, by long forbearing, this is Proverbs 25, you're going to 13. Proverbs 25 says, you're going to verse 13, chapter 13. By long forbearing, a prince is persuaded, and a soft tongue breaketh the bone. A soft tongue breaketh the bone. Just again talking about how, you know, how we respond to things, how we respond to anger, to wrath, to people who are indignant, you know, we can actually change their attitude. We can actually change them if we have the right response. If we have the soft tongue, the soft answer, the gentleness, the meekness that's supposed to be there as Christians, you know, that might actually change people's countenance towards us. It might change their intentions towards us. And in fact, it might, you know, bridge the gap, right? It might bring peace where before there was division. But here's the thing. That sounds easy, doesn't it? Oh, just give a gift. Just say something nice. A soft answer. A gift. It sounds easy, but it's hard because of the fact that we all have what's called pride, right? We all want to be right. We all want the other person to admit that they're wrong, right? Look at Proverbs chapter 13, verse 10. Only by pride cometh contention. Only by pride cometh contention. Whenever there's contention, there's pride. Whenever there's two people that are odds with another, where they can't come to a resolution, they can't have peace, there's pride involved, maybe on both sides. You know, often, you know, it's not even a matter of who's right or who's wrong when there's contention. A lot of times it's just you're both filled with pride. You both have pride involved, right? Because even if a person's right, you know, the Bible says it's a glory for a man to pass over a transgression. Right? Even when we're right, we don't have to be vindicated. You know what I'm saying? Oh, but I'm right. They don't have any right to be mad at me. They don't have any right to upset. I'm the one who's in the right here, and they need to admit it. That's pride. That is pride. The need to be vindicated publicly, to have your, whoever it is you're at odds with, admit that you're right. If you're going to insist on that, that's pride. And that's contention. Look, I'm not saying there isn't a time to stand up for what's right, okay? But often in our personal relationships, it's not some matter of, biblical importance that we're arguing over, right? It's two people that just don't get along. They don't see eye to eye. They have personality conflicts. You see this type of thing all the time in ministry where people just, they have an axe to grind, and then they just, they get their buddies and they go get their buddies, and it's just, they're just at odds with each other. And you say, well, who's right? Well, who cares? It's pride, because only by pride cometh contention. And, we should want to seek peace and just let things rest and just be at peace with people. And sometimes we, even when we're right, might have to just say, okay, whatever you want, you're right. And I know that'd be technically lying, but, or just give a soft answer. Hey, you know what? It's okay. It's not a big deal. Let's just let bygones be gone. Let's just let it be water on the bridge. Let's not make a big deal out of it. Let's just let things blow over. That's how we should seek to live our lives. I mean, that's, if we want peace in our lives, that's how we should seek to live our lives. I mean, isn't life stressful enough? Isn't life just hard enough without going out and having to have bitter, envying strife with other people over? I mean, people get so mad at each other, and they stay mad so long, they don't even know what they're mad about anymore. They can't even remember what set it off, right? Like the Hatfields and McCoys, right? It's like, what are you fighting about? Well, his name's Hatfield. Well, what are you fighting him for? Well, his name's McCoy. Right, but what started the whole thing? I don't know. But he's a Hatfield, and he's a McCoy. And we're going to fight. I don't know if anyone down here in the Southwest knows anything about the Hatfield McCoys. But it's a it's two hillbillies that just fight out in the woods for no reason, right? They're just constantly quarreling at each other. I'm mad at her. And, well, what did she do? I don't know. But I remember whatever it was bad, and she was wrong. Well, what did she do? I don't know. Right? It doesn't, that's a dumb way to live your life. We should seek to be people that just forget about things and not hang on to things and stay mad at people and be bitter about things and just not let things go. That's not any kind of way to live your life. Because, if we get into a habit of doing that, then that's going to be the rest of our life. Because here's the thing, people are always going to be doing things that upset us. People are, not constantly, but, you're gonna have people that come into your life that offend you. You're going to have people come into your life that do things you don't like and hurt your feelings and everything else. And we have to learn to just let these things go. Obviously there's a limit. I get it. Like, if they're going to come in and do harm to us physically or harm our family or something like that, yeah, we're gonna get mad. We're going to stay mad and we're going to fight for what's right. But, that's not, how often is that? I went to work and he parked in my spot. Everyone knows that's my spot. Does it have a sign with your name on it? No, but everyone knows that's my spot. Like, I've dealt with this, right? It wasn't said like that. They were like, hey, just so you know, that's where I always park. There's like six parking spots on the other side. I was like, well, I'm new here. That's where I'm parking now. So what now? I'm just like, it's like, okay, well, I'll park somewhere else. He's just like, I just really like parking in this spot in front of that tree. That's my tree. And I'm just like, okay, I'll park. And they were like, oh, I'm so glad you were nice about it. I wasn't sure how you were going to react. I was going to work, and I just started parking. I was new there. And this went on for weeks. And then finally, this gal worked up the courage to confront me about where I was parking every morning. And then I have a work van where I park. And I park it in a particular spot, and then I would start coming back from work, to report back to headquarters to park my van, and somebody else would park in my spot, and I had to park three spots down, and I have to fight this stuff too. I was like, I'm gonna go in there, and it was a police officer, right? Because we have campus police. It was a cop car. I'm gonna go into the station there. I'm gonna find out which one of these lieutenants is parking in my spot. I'm gonna tell them. It's like, how do you think that's gonna go? You and I did is just parked in the other spot, right? It's a silly example, but people get upset over petty things, don't they? People make mountains out of molehills. People get offended over just these little things, and they just blow them way out of proportion, and then it just, it can ruin relationships. And we, you know, what I'm saying is you're going to have plenty of opportunity in life to be offended at people and be upset and be angry. And you shouldn't. You should seek peace. And you should use these tactics, right, if necessary. You got some mortal enemy at work or whatever, it's like, say something nice. Be humble, be meek, help them out in some way. Whatever. Find ways. Don't just dig in your heels and be like, yeah, we're going to go at it, you know. So, you know, that's, you know, I'm trying not to preach two sermons tonight. But I do want to wrap up this chapter tonight. So, you know, this we're seeing, again, some of the qualities of Jacob. You see a lot of his qualities coming out and the way he reacts. And the first thing we're seeing is that, well, let me point it out because I don't know if I've read it. In verse 8, he said, what meanest thou by all this drove which I met? And he said, these are to find grace in the sight of my Lord. Right? So you can see that's kind of the culmination of the two things we talked about. His words, he's finding the grace sight of my Lord. Right? Some humility in that language. And what they're talking about, right? The drove. These are a gift, right? Because I'm trying to smooth things over with us. Okay? I don't want any bad blood. And Esau, you know, he says, I have enough. And he kind of has to, you know, tell him to take it. And he ends up taking it. It says, end of verse 11, and he urged him and he took it. So he takes the gift. And verse 12, he says, and he said, let us, this is Esau speaking, take our journey and let us go, and I will go before thee. Right? These 400 guys, I just came out to protect you. And that's all they're here for. Maybe that's the case. I don't know. Interesting story. And he said unto him, my Lord knoweth that the children are tender, and the flocks and herds are young. And the herds with young are with me. And if men should overdrive them one day, all the flock will die. Let my Lord, I pray thee, pass over before a servant. I will lead on softly according as the cattle that goeth before me, and the children be able to endure until I come unto my Lord. I come to my Lord unto Seir. And Esau said, let me now leave with thee some of the folk that are with me. And he said, what needeth it? Let me find grace in the sight of my Lord. And Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. And Jacob journeyed to Succoth. And then, of course, he settles down there. And that leads into chapter 34. But the point I want to make here is that, you know, he says in verse 14, you know, I will lead on softly according as the cattle that goeth before me, and the children be able to endure. This is a good principle when it comes to leadership, right? You don't want to overdrive people. You can't really expect more from people than what they're capable of doing. You know, this can be another source of frustration in our lives. You know, if we want to get more out of people than they're actually capable of doing, you know, then we're just setting them up for failure. And we're just setting ourselves up for, disappointment. And, you know, so that's a really good principle to be somebody who leads, again, gently, right? Leads softly, okay? And I do want to look a little bit tonight, just very quickly, at a couple passages in the New Testament. So if you would, go over to 2 Timothy chapter number 2. I've quoted a lot of these recently. I've even touched on this a little bit in other sermons, but, you know, it's here in the text again tonight. And I think it ties in with what Jacob had done earlier. We see, you know, Jacob's a very thoughtful and humble man, right? He's got a good head on his shoulder. He's thinking, okay, how are we going to pacify Esau? Okay, so he's considerate. He's a very considerate person. He's considerate, obviously, of his own skin, right, in the situation, but also of those that are with him. He doesn't want them to suffer necessarily. He puts them in the droves. He puts himself out front, and he sends a gift before them. He uses his words wisely. He's humble, and he's meek, and he's being gentle. And he pacifies Esau, assuming that it was there, which I'm kind of the opinion that it was. But it also, you know, he's very considerate in that way, but he's also considerate of the people that he's leading, right? Not just the conflict that he has to resolve in his life, but also the people that are looking to him for leadership, right? That he's being considerate of their shortcoming. I don't want to call it a shortcoming, right? You can't really, you know, a child only being able to walk so fast is not really a shortcoming. I mean, they're a child, right? You know, it always surprised me sometimes. My kids will walk with me, and, you know, they won't hold my hand, and it's like all of a sudden I have to go from, you know, taking these little baby steps, right? You can't just be like, come on, you want to walk with me? This is how fast we walk. You know, you're going to pull an arm out of the socket, you're going to scrape a knee, they're not going to want to be with you, right? What's your problem? You know, it's like they have a gait like this, you know, they can't, that's just how fast they walk. You can't really hold it against them. It's not a fault. You know, we're not all, made equal in that way. Some people are stronger physically. Some people have more fortitude. Some people have more ability than others in certain areas. It's just the way it is, right? So when it comes to leading, whether it's in your home or wherever, you know, you have to be considerate of the people that you're leading. And you can't expect more from them than they're actually capable of doing, okay? You have to lead softly, right? And it kind of, you know, obviously there were other people that were with him that were more than capable of going faster, probably even than himself, right? I mean, his grown sons are probably, you know, they're younger, full-grown men. They could probably outpace Jacob even, right? But Jacob's saying, we're not moving any faster than the slowest of us. We're not leaving anyone behind, right? And I think that's a good principle. I think that's something that we should keep in mind, you know, as leaders, as fathers, right? Let's be considerate of the fact that, you know, the Bible says that our wives, the woman, is the weaker vessel, right? But the Bible also says that men ought to honor, you know, their wives and not, you know, in a sense of, you know, dwelling with them according to knowledge, right? Meaning you don't expect more than what they're capable of doing, okay? Same for children. You know, the Bible says, fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. Okay? What does that mean? I think that's referring to setting an unattainable standard. And it's kind of cliche. Like, you might have heard that. You know, the overbearing father. Nothing's ever good enough. Right? But that's a real thing. Right? A father who sets the bar. I'm not saying don't set a bar. Right? I'm not saying that. I'm saying set a bar. By all means, have standards. But make them attainable. You know, kids want to attain things. They want the sense of accomplishment. They want the sense of a job well done. They like to be encouraged. They like to hear, hey, good job. They like to be, they like, you know, having that sense of, you know, ability, right? That they're competent in something, that they are smart and they can achieve and do things, right? But we don't want to set these unrealistic standards. We don't want to set this bar so high that they can't. You're just setting up someone for frustration at that point, okay? So I think that's a good principle. He's considerate, right? He's considerate of the problems he has to deal with, right? Potential problems, but he's also considerate of the people that he's leading. And if you notice in both instances, what do you see there? You see humility, you see meekness, right? In him as a leader. There's humility and meekness. That's like the main ingredient to all this. Humility and meekness. Because again, only by pride cometh contention. You want to smooth that over? Someone's just going to have to, you know, take it on the chin. Someone's just going to have to swallow some lumps and just be the bigger man or whatever. Take the high road and just let bygones be bygones and just let things, smooth things over. Right? That's how you resolve things. Someone has to just be willing to, you know, like Paul told the Corinthians, you know, why not just suffer yourselves to be defrauded rather to, you know, they were taking each other to court in the church. They were suing each other and he was rebuking them. You know, you go to court and that before the world, before the unbelievers. He said, why not you just rather suffer yourself to be defrauded? It would be better to just let a brother rip you off than to go out and sue him in court, right? But that takes humility, doesn't it? That takes a lot of meekness. To suffer a wrong like that. But that's what it takes often to resolve conflict. Is you have to just be willing to let things go. And you know, that's why the Bible just talks about so much about, we're just admonished and commanded even in the New Testament to be humble and to be meek, right? And of course, that's done through the Spirit, right? That is one of the fruits of the Spirit, to have meekness, right? Gentleness. As it puts it. I don't know where I had you go. I've been rambling for so long. Where are you at? 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 24. And the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle unto all men, apt to teach, patient. right? That's a requirement for a servant, right? Maybe, you know, obviously Timothy being a bishop, being an elder, being a pastor, this is something that's absolutely necessary for the ministry. But if we're going to serve to God in any capacity, you know, we have to be gentle unto other people. We have to be patient. You know, we want to teach people, but we have to be patient and let people come to the, get things, right? Sometimes people don't always get things. You preach things, you teach things, you show things to people in the Bible. Sometimes it goes over their head. You know, should we just be like, what's the point? You know, they're never going to get it. No. You have to be gentle. You might have to preach it again and again. That's why he said to preach with all long suffering and doctrine, right? Because sometimes we forget what we've learned, and sometimes it takes a long time to get something through our heads, right? But that's just the way human nature is. You know, that's why he's saying we have to be gentle, okay? Be considerate of the people that you're trying to instruct. Go over to, and I'll wrap up, go to 1 Thessalonians chapter number 2. And I think sometimes, you know, we especially as men, we don't like this because sometimes people can perceive meekness as weakness, right? You know, sometimes, you know, we as men, we always kind of want to puff our chests out and kind of let the other guy know who's really in charge. We know I'm the alpha around here, whatever, right? And so it's hard sometimes for us as men especially just be like, hey, you know, it's cool, and not have to prove something to somebody, right? But, you know, there's nothing weak about being a meek person. Don't mistake meekness for weakness. Don't mistake gentleness and kindness as a sign of, you know, of being some kind of a whelp, of being some kind of a weakling, right? Often it's the bigger man that has to do that. And I don't mean physically. I'm saying, like, it's the guy with more integrity that has to be that way, right? Look at, and just in case you're wondering, you know, Paul was such a man. You know, Paul was a man who showed great meekness, great gentleness, right? So lest we think that meekness and gentleness is something that is just unmanly or something, well, one, I'd point you to Jacob, the example from tonight. We know Jacob was a man's man. I mean, remember when he first went to Laban all those years ago, he rolled that stone off the well that it said they have to run. He had physical strength, right? But it's not just physical strength that makes men strong. It's the ability to be able to get along and lead. And you could still be strong and manly and hardworking and all that and still be a gentle and meek person and be a humble person. I mean, we would probably all agree that the Apostle Paul was an incredibly bold man. You know, the it says that he was, you know, his presence is weak, right? But his speech is powerful. You know, people reading the scripture, they get the impression that he was a man of low stature. He wasn't a real big guy, right? But he had, nonetheless, I'm sure Paul was probably an intimidating presence, right? Not that he intended to be an intimidating person, right? But just because of his boldness of speech, the knowledge that he had, the boldness that he had, the example that he was, the kind of life that he lived, he was, you know, because the people that we look up to, you know, through no fault of their own, they can sometimes be intimidating, right? Because we kind of lift them up on a pedestal. We put them up there as an example, and then they can kind of, that it, we feel like now they're kind of looking down on us. It's like, well, they're not, first of all. You know, they're just doing what they're supposed to be doing, right? But we would probably all agree that Paul, if Paul walked in tonight, you'd probably say, shut up, deacon, Paul's here. Let's let him I'd be like, amen, let's let Paul preach tonight, right? He's probably was an intimidating guy to be around for some people, I'm sure, right? But even Paul, as powerful and as bold as he was, talked about about being meek, about being gentle, right? And I like the illustration that he uses here in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 6. He says, nor of men sought we glory, neither of you, nor yet of others, that we might have been burdensome as the apostles of Christ, but we were gentle among you. Now, he could have put a period right there, right? Be like, oh, Paul was gentle, right? Paul was a gentle guy. Still manly, still hard worker, still something, you know, other guys could look up to, a great leader, right? But we get it, he was gentle. But I like how the illustration he uses in the latter half of the sentence. Even as a nurse cherisheth her children. That's not a, you know, I'll be honest, that's not how I perceive this church. So yeah, that's not how I, you know, examine the dynamic between me and the church here. Like, well, you know, I try to treat them like a nursing child that I'm bringing up, right? You know, maybe I should, I don't know. But isn't that's kind of almost a feminine description, isn't it? Right? That's not exactly the strongest. I mean, a nursing mother is not a very intimidating person, right? It's obvious, it's very nurturing, very caring, but there's a lot of long-suffering, gentleness involved there, right? You know, my wife has nursed 5 kids, and there was a lot of patience and meekness and gentleness. You can't make these kids do what they're supposed to do when it comes to that, right? You're kind of on their terms, right? You got to kind of work them through it. I'm not going to go into all the details, right? But that's the illustration that Paul used. Hey, we were gentle among you like a nurse who cherisheth her children. He's talking about like a nursing child, right? Who's succoring a child, right? He's like, that's how we were. You know, and look, babies can be fussy and they can eat at all hours. They're not on any kind of a schedule. They do what they want, right? It can be really frustrating work to nurse a child. It's exhausting, in fact, right? But it's got to be done, okay? And if you're going to do it and you're going to stick with it, you're going to have to be a very meek, gentle, and patient person, right? The same is true when it comes to leadership. To whatever degree we lead, to our interactions with other people, we have to be gentle and meek, and it's not easy, right? Especially if, you know, we tend to have a streak of pride in us, you know, and that's something that we as men typically do struggle with more than ladies. Look, women can have it too, but it's typically more of a man's sin to have pride, right? Because we as men, you know, we want to be looked up to. We want people to, you know, mostly, like we want people to, we care about getting respect. It's important to a man to be respected and to have people, you know, treat us with respect, right? But that can also turn into a source of pride, right? So if we're going to be gentle and meek to other people, we're going to have to keep our pride in check. You know, and I think, you know, that's something that Jacob was really good at, right? Jacob, because again, you know, and I don't want to turn you all the way back there, but even in his prayer to God in chapter 32, he says, you know, I'm not worthy, right? He's basically confessing his own unworthiness before God. He's not worthy of all the wisdom and grace that he's given him. So you can see these attributes in Jacob, and they're in every great leader in the Bible. You know, his gentleness, meekness, right? Moses was the meekest man in all the earth. We certainly would call that guy a weak guy. But there, before, I would say that the prerequisite to those attributes is an absence of pride. It's humility. It's got to be there, okay? Let's go ahead and close in a word of prayer. Dear Lord, again, thank you for this great story.